Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast. My name is Raphael Burm. I'm part of the EAN's Communication Committee and the AI Task Force that was newly founded. Today's topic is Clinical Neurology Meets AI. Are we prepared? And to answer this question, I have the wonderful Roland Wiest with me today, who is, of course, a frequent flyer at EAN Cast and other EAN media productions. But for today's episode, his most important, I would say, role is that he is the Vice Director of the Department of Digital Medicine at Bern, where he has many other roles, particularly in neuroimaging and radiology. Roland, we're going to talk about how AI tools are being integrated into clinical practice as we speak. I think we all feel that this is happening at a very rapid pace. If we think back about the GPT revolution that has happened, I'm going to say 3 years. I don't know, maybe it was four. It feels like it could have been 10. And how now only slowly after the initial excitement of being able to chat to these computers, we see how they are actually influencing our daily lives, be it in or outside of the hospital. So my first question to you is, well, are we prepared? And if so, what are the areas that we should prepare for most?
Yeah, so Raphael, thank you for this kind introduction. I'm really happy to be with you here today. And you have already addressed, I think, the most important question, are we prepared? I would say we are only in a limited way prepared, because if you review, let's say, the production of artificial intelligence tools that have received at this current stage, the marketing level, we count approximately 1,500 of them if we review, for example, the FDA boards. And it's a jungle. It's a jungle that needs us to be at least knowledgeable about the navigation among these tools. If it comes to neurology, I would say then we would identify still as one of the main use cases the employment of analytics of clinical decision support in neuroimaging. This is definitely one of the tools that are mostly advanced, that have mostly advanced in the last time. We have, of course, the domain of neurophysiology, where also automated signal analysis has made a lot of advances. We have the huge domain of automation in clinical workflows, and something that is coming and that is getting more and more interest, that is automated writing of reports, that is also what's called ambient listening. So that means tools that record the exchange between patients and clinicians, neurologists, and try to sort out the most important content of these dialogues. This happens, for example, not only in the hospital environment. There are new things to come that also try to work in a pre-hospital phase. For example, if a stroke patient is admitted to a hospital, so to retrieve the most important facts and informations and send them to the hospitals before the patient reaches the emergency room. So there are really lots. And since there are so many applications, it's rather difficult to navigate through this jungle, as I said before.
Yeah, I think you touch on a very interesting point, which is the FDA approval. There is also an EMA approval way that's not entirely mandatory right now. It probably will be at some point in the future. As a clinician in the field of neurology, let's say general neurology, what is your recommendation? How should I try and educate myself about what are actually useful tools right now? Is there like another sign that I can look for, some sort of like a stamp of approval from some organization? Or how do you approach that?
Yeah. So we have different, let's say, possibilities to review data. Of course, there is, for example, the homepage of the FDA, where you can, screen all the different technologies that have been cleared in the United States. As you mentioned, this is not something that is, allowing a legal clearance for Europe, but you get information. You get information about how these systems have been developed. You are informed about some studies that have been conducted and that led to the clearance. You also will be informed about the fast track versus the, let's say, in-depth clearance processes that are there. There are, at least in my domain, in the domain of neuroimaging, there are different other possibilities. There are private companies in Europe that offer similar homepages where you can go through them. You can see what is the level of clearance, what is the purpose of these tools, which kind of, let's say, prerequisites are needed to run these tools in the clinical services. And most importantly, they also provide a list on literature, on evidence that is already there for these tools. There is a similar tool that has been built by the American College of Radiology, which also allows you to retrieve these different informations. But at the end, it's not structured by now. So we have this gap. We don't have structured recommendations which kind of tools can be used. I think the most important question to answer and the first one to be answered is always to see, do you have a medical product that is certified? If it's a medical product and if the environment where this product is running, either as an on-prem solution within the hospital firewalls or as a cloud-based solution, it needs to have a certification as a medical product to use it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. If you don't see that CE or FDA certificate, better not use it for sensitive medical data.
Right. And this brings me to one important point. So you should never put your sensitive data on ChatGPT, for example, to write a report or even just to condense information, because this is really something that is dangerous and not within the legal frameworks of any country.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point that you raised this again. If you put something into ChatGPT, you explicitly give them the allowance and the right to train on this data, so this will be saved. So it's not like Googling something. You actually put this data in. So if you put your own personal information in, well, that's at your own risk, but if you put your patient's information in, that does violate privacy laws. You mentioned another thing that I'm really curious about, which is EEG or neurophysiology pattern recognition. It's something that, from my point of view, has been surprisingly slow. When you look at it, it's not that much signal, I guess. But for some reason, it seems to be eluding sort of the pattern recognition models. What's your take on that? How is the future looking for automated EEG?
Yeah, so I don't, honestly, to be honest, I have not reviewed the most recent advances in that field. But it comes, for me, it's quite straightforward, because you can train the system's relatively easy on signal recognition. So therefore, I think it makes a lot of sense to have this kind of, for it, specifically if you have long-term EEG recordings, for example, or if you have sleep recordings, these systems can be employed. I don't honestly have a current, let's say, information about the last, most recent information in the literature, but from the use case, I would say this is a very nice one. And it's kind of, yeah, in some instances, quite similar to what we do in neuroimaging, because it's pattern recognition and classification.
Yeah, I imagine if you look through, as you said, like a 24 hours recording, something that just filters out the areas where there's nothing happening and just directs you to those that need attention, I think that would be a tremendous speed increase.
Maybe just to add something to that, because there's a similar principle that's currently emerging in the field of neuroimaging, that's the anomaly detection. So instead of training the data on pathologies, you train the data on the normal or on the normative appearance of certain even signals or images. And then these kind of anomaly detectors, they spot the differences to the normal data. This gives one the opportunity to train this data on really large data sets, because it's much easier to get, let's say, normal data and to train the system. And then it will spot any anomaly without giving a classification. And this allows you to review this anomaly and then to justify or to determine if this is a relevant finding or not.
Yeah, that makes so much sense, right? Because I think we're always in this space, also having to confront a little bit the fear of, I think, providers that eventually they'll be replaced. And I think this goes much more into the direction of the co-pilot analogy, where there is something flying along with you and it's going to highlight and it's going to steer. Maybe at some point it can take over the wheel for a couple of, you know, like hours, but eventually it's you who is in the driving seat and who's making these decisions. You mentioned ambient listening before, something that I've just seen anecdotally pop up in advertisements much more. I know that the Americans use that quite a bit. I mean, they've also already had the profession of the medical scribe, something that I'm not aware of as much in Europe. Is this something that's happening in your practice? Do you see that coming soon to other fields?
Well, at the moment, it's at the level of not being fully clinically implemented, but there's a lot of research projects going on. I think there's also, I think it's a huge difference where you want to use it. If you want to use it in an emergency room, for example, where you have a lot of noise, where you have a lot of distraction in between people talking to each other, and maybe even patients that can either hardly speak or speaking in a different language, then it's still something that is not completely solved. There's a lot of artifacts. There's a lot of, let's say, errors within the systems. But if you do it in a, let's say, a shielded or a protected environment, I'm just thinking about more lengthy communications, for example, in the domain of psychiatry or in patients with chronic disorders that you see for, let's say, the fifth or the tenth time within your ward, and you are discussing with them the progression of a certain disorders, then this works already pretty well. So it's rather dependent, indeed, on the use case. I would say it's pretty much advanced now in the field of chronic disorders and yes, more extensive discussions with the patients, whereas there is still some need for improvement in the actionable rooms of an emergency environment.
Yeah, that makes sense. I come from the field of cognitive neurology, so I talk to patients with dementia a lot, and I think there it can work wonderfully. And it's also, I think, one of the good examples where if we use this technology in the right way, it will actually free up time and headspace for us to go back to the human-human interaction. Because right now what's happening, I mean, just think, if you're going to your physicians, what's going to happen is you're going to talk to them and they'll be on the keyboard typing. They'll be looking at screens, they'll be typing away, and they'll be doing this while talking to you. So if something can just pick up your conversation and make something meaningful out of this, it would free up a lot of space. I think that would be beneficial to both parties.
I have always this wish, and this is something that is more recently also proposed in the domains of computational science research. It's this building, they call it a Kentaur or Kentauric system. So that means that humans can do or can execute the tasks that they can specifically well, like, for example, being empathic, listening, let's say, to subtle information that is provided by the patient, whereas the purely analytical process can easily be done by algorithms, and then the two work together as a team at the end. And of course, in the best of all cases, then the human physician has additional information to make decisions. But I think we should invest much more on this vision of having man-machine interfaces instead of these discussions about replacements.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. And I think, of course, there is this pull towards automating things also for productivity gains. But I see the most important use cases right now, as you also already mentioned, in things that are extremely tedious, that don't require a lot of what we are actually good at, right? It's not the physical examination that is going to be automated. It's not the talking to a patient and having, like, I mean, there's lots of research into that when people have a gut feeling, it is actually them taking in so much information and then having a hunch based off of something that's actually tangible. And I am really hoping that AI can take away a lot of these tasks in my daily practice that are extremely repetitive and, to be frank, just a bit stupid. I want to build on that for the next question is, because we're talking about the matter of preparedness today, how can, say, I'm in a practice or say I'm in a hospital and I want to be ready for these tools when they come? Is there anything I can do to my data right now? Is there any way I can prepare the way I collect data right now to be ready for AI?
It depends a lot on the environment where you're working for. So I think many hospitals are currently trying to solve this problem by having a kind of, let's say data. So this is, I hate this word, but they call it data warehouses. So you have structured environment where you can save this data. Then if you want to retrieve this data, you make a formal application to the data protection officer, then it's cleared how you can use this data. But in general, I think everything that can be standardized, that can be somehow digitalized, should be digitalized. So that means clinical hospitals need to rethink about their formats. One easy way, or one not easy, it's an expensive way, but maybe some reasonable way, is of course to move forward to electronic health records. This is currently done in many centers in Europe, where you have some kind of pre-structured data. Of course, you should try wherever it's possible to have also implementations of structured reports. And if you don't have this kind of structured reports, then with tools like large language models, you can try to condense the information and to structure it in a secondary way. You need to have some, let's say, storage, protected storage, where you can also save the laboratory data, where you can save the imaging data in a structured way. But I think the key element there is a strategic thinking. It's the strategic thinking about implementing a protected research environment that fulfills the criteria. So that means it cannot be entered, it cannot be hijacked from external, let's say, sites. It needs to have a governance in place who is allowed to use this kind of data, and then you need to have access. And this is, I think this is a long-term project, and it will not be solved within half a year. So for now, I would really, if you want to prepare your data and you have a certain use case in mind, then the only advice I can give is try to structure it as good as possible from the very beginning.
Right. You mentioned LLMs, and obviously we're talking about AI. You mentioned that before. When we think about commercial AI applications right now, they all happen in the cloud, right? So I go to any of the big names, and I will enter my whatever it is, query or prompt, and then it will calculate somewhere else. Obviously, for healthcare data, we would like to do this more local. Do you think that this is something we should also prepare for on a hardware side? Do I need to buy lots of GPUs right now?
Yes, I think this is the ongoing discussion. Is there, what are the arguments for having on-premise solutions versus cloud-based? And I think there are, it's a very differentiated way how we should try to analyze this. Because, of course, if it comes to safety, then the best solution will always be to have on-prem solutions. This comes with certain shortcomings, because you need to build infrastructure, which is still doable. So you need to have your own servers within your hospital environment, but you need the people. You need people that are relatively costly to run these systems and to maintain these systems in the hospital environment. But if you can, let's say, manage that, if you can afford it, then they are a perfect solution for starting with AI implementations. Other options, and we have been following that now for several years, is to go into a different direction, to have platforms with integrated AI solutions that are working cloud-based. Then, of course, you need to fulfill national requirements, regulatory requirements. That means you need to put your server into safe areas. You cannot put it everywhere. In the best case, you have it within your own country. Then you have to have a process for de-identification. You need to build a security concept that also describes what would happen if there would be, let's say, a data breach, or if there would be an attack to the system. From an economical perspective, if you have, let's say, not that many cases, and you have an arrangement with the company with a pay-per-use, then usually the cloud solutions are the ones that are more economically implementable. Because I think that the costs for the service, and specifically the cost for the personnel, should not be underestimated. If you want to build a really high throughput system, like, for example, a national stroke analytics system that tries to find, for example, large vessel occlusion, and where you have a relatively, let's say, limited pretest probability, you can have the stroke mimics that are running through the systems also, now, then you will end up in a high number of data that will be processed by these systems, and then the cloud-based solutions may be rather expensive. There, an on-prem solution that is installed within the hospital may save money. So you cannot say the one is better than the other. You might either consider the safety aspects, which are definitely on the side of on-prem solutions, where in a low to mid-size range for data computing, the cloud solutions are more economically implementable.
Right, so it really depends on your use case. I think we've covered a lot of ground in the last couple of minutes. I think I want to quickly emphasize the main points you made and then ask you if you want to add something. So I think we can see that AI and clinical neurology is an area that's going to intersect even further in the future. We'll see more and more applications. You mentioned that in imaging, we're maybe shifting towards flagging of abnormalities, but you also mentioned, of course, the large vessel occlusion, which flags a specific pathology. We see that ambient listening, so taking notes as you speak, is something that is actively being developed and I think very useful right now if you talk a lot to your patients. So think psychiatry, think dementia, think outpatient visits that are frequently around the same topic but might need some more work in busy environments. You talked about pattern recognition in neurophysiology, which is making, I think, also great improvements. We talked about that if you want to prepare, if you want to be one of the early adopters, the most important thing you can do right now is just structure your data and store it locally in an accessible way. And then for the future, it might depend on your use case. If you want to go safety, you go local. But if you have something that's not as easily scalable, then maybe a cloud-based solution that also obviously is within all regulatory premises might be something that's more economical for you. But if I hear you correctly, you are also quite convinced that the future will see AI being much more tightly integrated into our clinical environment.
Yeah, I think clearly I have no doubts that this is a next and very disruptive step. But it's on us. It's on us physicians to structure it, to organize it, but also to build the regulations for the use of artificial intelligence. And this brings me maybe to my final point. We should invest now into the education of our younger colleagues. We need to have some kind of baseline, as you mentioned, we need to have some kind of baseline training. How is AI working? What are use cases? What are also the, let's say, the legal, the environmental, the financial, and the ethical aspects that are needed to run this safely in a hospital environment? So we need to think much more now about structured educations, even about certifications that are recognizable and that open new career paths for young physicians. And of course, we should take the opportunity not to, let's say, just show up as customers of companies, but to actively seek this public-private partnerships and to open networks together with developers, with industries, with universities, in order to shape the developments of new tools according to the needs that we as neurologists, as physicians have, and really to make sure that these tools that are concepted fulfill the requirements that we have in a clinical practice.
Yeah, that's a great last point. And I want to emphasize that people should look to EAN for exactly that. I think we're actively developing, we're actively thinking about these sorts of educational material, but also certificates in the future. And this is exactly what the AI task force has been set up to do. And I agree, this needs to be something where we're an essential part of the driving forces to move this forward, not only for us, but mostly for our patients. So with that, Roland, I thank you very much for joining me on this cast today. Wish you a very pleasant day. May not many helicopters fly over you. And I hope to see you soon.
Thank you for the moderation. It was a pleasure to be here.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.